Chapter 21. A Visit to Athens. Athens was in some respects the most interesting of all the cities in Europe. No city had such literary associations. None had a longer roll of great names which it held in honor. Paul must have looked forward with no little interest to a visit there. One who visits even at this day the historic land of Greece feels the thrill of Byron's lines that ring with the memories of dead glories and victories long past. Clime of the unforgotten brave, whose land from plain to mountain cave was freedom's home or glory's grave. Shrine of the mighty, can it be that this is all remains of thee? Approach, thou craven, crouching slave. Say, is not this Thermopylae? These waters blue that round you lave, O servile spring of the free, pronounce what sea, what shore is this? The gulf, the rock of Salamis. 'Twere long to tell and sad to trace each step from glory to disgrace. Enough, no foreign foe could quell thy soul till from itself it fell. Yes, self-abasement paved a way to villain bonds and despot sway. The glorious days of Greece are past, were past in Byron's day, and even in the day of Paul. But the Parthenon was standing in Paul's day, not as now a melancholy ruin, but a gleaming crown of architectural glory on the summit of the Acropolis. Even then it was Greece, but living Greece no more. But the memorials of ancient greatness were not as now mere sepulchres of their own past. Glad as Paul must have been to visit Athens, he was not happy in the conditions which led to the visit, for he had been driven out of one city after another, and was not here to work, but merely to retire for a little time from the tumults which his preaching had created. The visit of Paul to Athens occurred while he was upon the second of his missionary journeys. He arrived not far from November 1st, probably in the year 51, and stayed there perhaps a month or 6 weeks. His being there would seem almost an accident. He seems to have come to Athens with less of purpose, and to have wrought with less of direct method than was his custom. Indeed, it hardly seemed to have been for the sake of the work he might do in that city that he was there. He had been to Philippi, and had been beaten and imprisoned. He had preached in Thessalonica, and had escaped from the ensuing tumult in the night. From Thessalonica he had gone to Berea, where his work, though sufficiently encouraging to warrant the continued labor of Timothy and Silas, encountered opposition which resulted in Paul's departure from Berea and his coming to Athens. He appears to have left Berea without any very definite plans, except to get away from Berea to some spot where he might wait for Silas and Timothy to finish their work and join him in labor elsewhere. If he had chosen a destination, it was probably Corinth. To Athens he was conducted by faithful brethren from Berea, apparently out of consideration for the apostle's defective vision and feeble health, which made him always reluctant to be alone. These brethren, having found him a comfortable lodging at Athens, returned at once to Berea. We are able to detect here Paul's uncertainty and some apparent changes of plan. By the time he had reached Athens, his need of Timothy and Silas, his reluctance to be left alone, and some hastily formed plan for work, possibly in Athens itself, prompted him to send a message by the returning Bereans, instructing Silas and Timothy to leave their work at Berea and join him immediately. A few days later, discouraged by his own failure in Athens, he left the city prematurely, apparently sending to his companions as he was leaving a message involving a further change of plan, informing them that they were to meet him not in Athens but in Corinth, but that Timothy must first go to Thessalonica, where his work had been so abruptly cut off, to establish the converts there. By adding to the narrative in Acts the statements that creep out in the first of Paul's letters to the Thessalonians, written only a few months later, we are able to follow quite closely Paul's train of thought in these days. He remembers keenly the shame of his experience at Philippi. He recalls the promising beginning of his work there. He seems to himself to have been baffled by Satan. He fears that all his labor there has been in vain. The possible power of idolatry to tempt his converts back into idol worship grows upon him as he sees Athens wholly given up to it. At last, with an anxiety and affection that he can no longer control, and at cost to him of loneliness and self-denial, he sends word to Timothy to delay his coming to Paul's relief and go first to Thessalonica again. Wherefore, when we could no longer forbear, we thought it good to be left behind at Athens alone, and sent Timothy, our brother and God's minister in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and to comfort you concerning your faith. Not till Timothy joined him at Corinth, bringing an encouraging message from Thessalonica, did Paul's cloud lift. Now, alone in Athens, it was at its blackest. Recalling the memories of sorrows just past, he tells the church with which he next labored that his flesh had no rest. Without were fightings, within were fears. He was troubled on every side. But when Timothy came even now unto us from you, and brought us glad tidings of your faith and love, and that ye also have good remembrance of us always, longing to see us, even as we also to see you, for this cause, brethren, we were comforted over you in all our distress and affliction through your faith. For now we live if ye stand fast in the Lord. During the time that he was in doubt on this point, he hardly seemed to himself to live. Picture to yourself the apostle as he appeared in Athens, lonely and sick at heart and suffering in body and mind. See him as he wanders about his thoroughly uncongenial surroundings, almost broken down by his anxieties and cares. He is troubled by his imperfect vision, troubled with the reaction of an active man in enforced inactivity amid strange scenes, troubled for his companions, whose voyage, if deferred, may be a perilous one. It is late in the season for navigation, and Paul knows well the perils by water. Troubled for the work which he has left incomplete, troubled with the memories of hardship and opposition, strife at Berea, hard work and peril at Thessalonica, stripes and imprisonment at Philippi, and no man ever lived more keenly sensitive to opposition and unkind treatment than Paul. Troubled for the future, for himself, for his work, which he was unable to plan for as he wishes, for his message, dearer to him than life, yet meeting with so unfavorable reception. Troubled on every side, as he tells us, he wanders about the city, reads its inscriptions, standing near and shielding his weak eyes from the light, gazes on its idols. And at this time it was said that one might sooner meet a god than a man in the streets of Athens. And with sorrow kindling into indignation, notes the combination of literary and aesthetic culture with spiritual degeneracy that everywhere forced itself upon him. He was in the home of Greek poetry and art and philosophy and eloquence, with the zenith of its glory past, and what had been a keen intellectual activity settled down into a shallow curiosity, and a spiritual torpor which tolerated all religions and gave little energetic faith to any. Many have thought that Paul's hearing in Athens on the Areopagus, where was held the Supreme Court, was a trial, but there was not enough of moral earnestness in Athens to produce even a heresy trial. At last Paul attracted the attention of the philosophers, and these grew so curious in their questions that they drew Paul into the Areopagus. It used to be supposed that Paul stood up in the midst of Mars Hill, but scholars now tell us that while the court was accustomed to meet there for formal trials, the name of the hill, Areopagus, was commonly applied to the members of the court, as well as to the hill on which they held their meetings, and that it would not have been likely that they would have taken him to this rather remote place of formal assembly. But certainly they may have done so, and there seems no improbability that this is what the word means. In any case, Paul stood before the philosophers who composed the High Court of Athens, and there is no reason why the discussion, perhaps lasting several days, led finally up to this climax, that one day the philosophers actually drew him into the stone semicircle on the top of Mars Hill itself, under the very shadow of the Parthenon. This is how it happened. Paul, when he arrived in Athens, had Timothy with him, but soon sent Timothy away to learn how the Christians they had left behind were getting on. Left alone in Athens, and making few friends, he waited for the Sabbath day. It was not a Jewish city, but there were some Jews there, and Paul learned where they were accustomed to worship. Paul sought out the synagogue, and there talked with the handful of Jews who gathered there. He does not appear to have preached. He conversed with those who assembled there, carrying on the conversation as they came out of the synagogue into the marketplace. They attracted more and more attention from those who chanced to overhear them, the group constantly increasing in number and dignity. Athens was a university town, full of philosophers and grammarians and teachers of rhetoric, full of students and Silists and Phaedus, among whom a new sensation spread rapidly. It was here, on Mars Hill, the Areopagus, that Paul's memorable sermon was delivered. The highest court in Athens, which was held here, had had before it many noted men. Although Paul was not on trial, but was treated with most polished and ironical politeness when requested to speak of his new religion, his hearers probably sat upon the seats of the judges, and he may well have stood where Socrates had taken his place 400 years before, when heard as Paul was now heard upon the same charge, that of setting forth strange gods. His sermon was short, and to the apostle its results were not at all satisfactory. How ought we to think of God? This was the question that Paul undertook to answer from truth held in common by himself and his audience. Whatever the origin and purpose of the altar to which Paul referred, some there must have been of those who worshipped there, who looked with a pure blind faith to a God above all the gods about them, as yet to them unknown. Some of his attributes, Paul tells them, are known to them and bestowed by them upon Jupiter. More than one of their poets, Hesiod, Pindar, Lucretius, had set forth more or less clearly his paternity of mankind. Especially had Cleanthes and Aratus, nearly contemporary poets of the 3rd century BC, expressed this idea. From the latter of these two, Paul seems to quote, in the beginning of his work on astronomy are these lines, from Jove we sprung, whom we mortals should ne'er leave unsung. Of Jove the public walks are full, and counsels all of men, both the sea and shore are full of him. From Jove comes all that we enjoy, for we are his offspring. These words from a heathen poet, Paul took as his text, and for his theme he took an altar which he had seen erected to the unknown God. Who erected that altar? What did he mean by it? Perhaps it was erected by some very misguided heathen who were afraid lest with all their gods they had omitted one. Perhaps it was the work of some devout men whom idol worship did not satisfy, who felt that still the true God had not been found through the worship of images. Paul did not speak of it harshly. He began by assuming that the altar showed that the people were religious, and since the altar was a confession that God was not known, he was at liberty to tell them about God. The sermon Paul preached that day is one of the most notable sermons ever preached. This is the story as Luke learned it afterward from Paul and wrote it down. And Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, ye men of Athens, in all things I perceive that ye are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. What therefore ye worship in ignorance, this I set before unto you. the God that made the world and all things therein, he, being Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is he served by men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he himself giveth to all life and breath and all things. And he made of one every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek God, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain even of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Being then the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone, graven by art and device of man. The times of ignorance therefore God overlooked, but now he commandeth men that they should all everywhere repent, inasmuch as he hath appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, in that he hath raised him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, We will hear thee concerning this yet again. Thus Paul went out from among them, but certain men clave unto him and believed, among whom also was Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. The shallow critical interest of his hearers soon broke out into open contempt. Only one of the influential men who heard him was converted. The rest refused to hear him through. Ridiculed and mocked, and Paul could endure even beating better than ridicule, with another weight added to the burden he was bearing, he left the city. He cherished no pleasant memories of his stay there. He wrote no epistle to the church there. He never visited the place again, though more than once he might have done so. More than likely he thought his effort there a complete failure. But a little church grew up there, and in time the Parthenon itself was rededicated as a Christian church. And in the Christian schools of Athens were trained bishops and apologists and orators and martyrs of the Christian faith. In the 6th century, Minerva, for whom the city was named, was supplanted in popular affection by Mary, the mother of Christ. The weak-eyed little fanatic with his strange religion was less than a 9 days' wonder in Athens. He was soon forgotten in the search for a new sensation, but men visit Athens less today to see where Socrates taught, and Plato reasoned, and Solon made laws, and Pericles ruled, and Demosthenes poured forth his mighty torrents of eloquence, than to stand where Paul stood on Mars Hill and preached his 2-minute sermon to a listless and mocking audience. A heathen altar was his theme, and a heathen poet furnished him his text, and his sermon stands unique, a model of polite and logical argument, and a sententious presentation of significant Christian truth. Paul's argument is a noble one. If we are the children of God, God must be like the best that is in us. We must never think that God is anything grotesque or hateful, as many idols were. We must never suppose him arbitrary or revengeful or partial or anything that would be unlovely in ourselves. We must never make creeds or other graven images of such sort that they limit our knowledge of God or our love for him. God is like the best that is in us, only God is vastly better.